Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In American music, the old sound is new again.
Our stepmom, we did everything to hate her. She took us down to the edge of Decatur. We saw the lion and the kangaroo take her down to the river where they caught a wild alligator.
Axl Rose and Guns N' Roses may have the headlines this week, but that's so 80s. When hipster music critic Amanda Petrusich went looking for the next American music, she found a sound both older and newer. American roots, Americana, and free folk, indie folk, alt country. This hour On Point, on the trail of the next American music, trailing roots all over. You can join the conversation. Are you plugged into Sufjan Stevens behind me here? To Iron and Wine, to Animal Collective, Caliphone, Freakwater. And what keeps the old sound of Mountain and Delta running through so much new American music? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And yes, later in the hour, we will also dip into the new Guns N' Roses Axl Rose album, Chinese Democracy. But first, joining me from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Amanda Petrusich. She's a staff writer for the online indie music site Pitchfork, senior contributing editor for Paste magazine, and a pop music critic for the New York Times. Her new book is It Still Moves, Lost Songs, Lost Highways, and the Search for the Next American Music. Amanda, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Tom. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And tell us what you were on the trail of here. I mean, both sort of musically and intellectually, but also literally in your car, you were looking back, hitting all the old great spots of really kind of Southern Americana roots music, and tracking, thinking a lot about this new turn on that music as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The book is very much a travelogue, and in many ways it's a very sort of personal journey. And I spent a lot of time thinking about how place affects art. You know, why did the blues begin in the Mississippi Delta, and how does that music reflect that landscape? And the bands that I end up focusing on towards the end of the book, when I talk about the next wave of Americana music, aren't necessarily the strictest revivalists, and I think we heard that a little bit with Sufjan Stevens there just a minute ago. Mm-hmm. They're not just parroting Americana, they're reinventing it in a way that correlates with what I understand as the new American landscape. So in the most basic terms, it's a mix of the organic and the synthesized. And I mean, right now, as you mentioned, I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia for the holiday, which is a city that I absolutely love. And just this morning, I was driving down Highway 29 on my way to the studio. And from the driver's seat of my car, you know, I can see the Blue Ridge Mountains, and they're these tremendous, beautiful peaks. And every few miles, they're interrupted by a giant Target sign. So when I hear a banjo right. being played alongside a synthesizer, or an auto harp being played next to a laptop, I mean, it makes sense to me in a really literal way, because I think it reflects this kind of new American landscape.
Mountains and the big box Target store all at one time. You're writing a lot in here about a kind of what you and others call it, really hyphenated music, you know, whether it's free folk, freak folk, indie folk, alt country. It is that old, new. It's also, as you describe it, what was the rootstock of this music coming from what was tied in with what's new. I mean, that the Target signs are there. The American landscape is no longer kind of just the Blue Ridge Mountains, just the Delta in its early form. And this is music that's what folk sounding in many ways, roots sounding, but bringing in very modern sentiment and sound at the same time.
Right. And I think, you know, to me, that's what roots music or what Americana music is really about. And I think over the last 100 years, you know, we've seen, starting with the earliest, the most sort of basic Americana sounds, which for me, I think are rooted in early you know, Appalachian folk and country and Delta blues, you know, we've seen the way in which those beginnings have kind of been reinvented and reimagined and, you know, in some cases perverted to sort of reflect these changes in American culture. I mean, I think we certainly saw that in Memphis in the 1950s with, you know, the birth of rock and roll, and we've seen it a zillion times since then. So it's exciting in a way. I think it keeps the music vital, and I have tremendous respect also for the artists that are doing sort of stricter revivals of this music and are playing it, you know, in the same ways in which it was played when it was first sort of invented. But I also think it's kind of neat to see it change, to sort of reflect these larger changes that we're talking about.
We're going to do some back and forth time travel with you in this hour, Amanda, as we kind of think about your road trip. We want to do a little musical travel here as well to hear some of that, the echoes of the old in the new. Let's put an old that many may know back to back with some new here, just to get a sense of where this evolution is taking American music. You call it the next American music, maybe. Here's 1929. This is Charlie Patton's Mississippi Boll Weevil Blues. Charlie Patton, a big inspiration for Robert Johnson. You talk about Delta music. Here's a little bit of the old original.
There's a little boll weevil keep moving in it, Lordy. You can plant your cotton and you won't get a heaven to stay, Lordy. Boll weevil, boll weevil, quiet your little hole, Lordy.
Boll weevil, boll weevil, sang Charlie Patton way back. That's a 1929 recording. And man, I mean, this is the old blues guru, gutsy, rambling kind of blues, and all the blues antics, tossing, cradling his guitar around, wrapping it around his neck, playing hard. Big inspiration for Robert Johnson, of course, who was one of the most famous Delta performers. That's the old. Now, I'm going to ask our listeners to hold that in mind here. We're going to turn to Iron and Wine. And before we hear it, introduce Sam Beam to us, if you would, Amanda.
Sure. Sam Beam is a folk singer originally from South Carolina, although when he recorded his first album, he was living in Florida, and now I believe he lives in Texas. But he, you know, has this kind of tremendous beard and this long, fantastic hair, and he plays these organic, really sort of scrappy, you know, kind of bare bones acoustic folk songs. I mean, since then he's added a full band and some instrumentation
right.
to his sound.
But he's
but
not
that
out
was
of a cabin
began.
In the woods. This is a Sam Beam's actually a college professor recorded this first album. We're going to hear from, I think it's the one. Here, Creek Dragged the Cradle, recorded in his basement.
Yeah, absolutely. And he sent off the tapes to Sub Pop Records, which, you know, I don't know how familiar everyone is with that label, but it was, you know, very much a sort of grunge kind of rock punk. You know, it was Nirvana's first label before they, you know, made the leap to a major and released the album that made them famous. So it was a, you know, it's not a folk label by any means. It's a label that kind of caters to, you know, sort of 20-something urban kids. So it was really remarkable in some ways that Sam Beam found such a fantastic home there.
So let's hold Charlie Patton in mind and listen to Sam Beam, Iron and Wine, Southern Anthem.
Just like the way that you ran.
Sam Beam, Iron and Wine, with Southern Anthem there. And Amanda, a lot jumps right to mind here. You quote Justin Tubb, son of country legend Ernest Tubb, once describing Americana as the music of the working man, the farmer, the trucker, the factory worker. Now, yes, we can hear that echo of Charlie Patton, but there's a very different sound here, too. And you write yourself, you say that now this kind of music is sort of lives in cities, coffee houses, admired by upper middle class, well-educated people, you know, collected and fetishized by academics and
right.
record store clerks. You can sort of hear that in the music itself, that move to the town, city.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I think we saw this also in the 60s with the sort of folk revival in New York City, you know, when when the Lomaxes kind of brought the folk singer Lead Belly to New York for the first time, and he was so quickly embraced by the, not only by the radical left, but also again by the, you know, academics, you know, mostly white, mostly wealthy people that lived in New York City. I mean, and it's remarkable, you know, they discovered him in jail, you know, where he was being imprisoned for murdering someone. So it's not unprecedented, this sort of shift from the kind of front porch to the you know, apartment in Brooklyn. I think that's happened before, but it's interesting in Sam Beam's case that this music appeals mostly to sort of younger people. You know, I mean, I don't know the exact precise demographics, but I'm presuming, you know, if it's in line with the people that Sub Pop usually sells to, it's, you know, 20-somethings, you know, the kind of kids with the ironic T-shirts and, you know, perhaps a trucker hat or two. And I know that when Sam Beam tours, he plays rock clubs, you know, I mean, he'll play these little tiny dark, you know, places with the huge stacks of speakers where, you know, a couple nights ago it may have been a punk band. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly a departure from what I think people think of as the kind of traditional coffee house sort of folk circuit. You know, in his case, it's interesting.
So it's that hip set in Brooklyn, young, in the middle of the city, still looking back to that Delta front porch in a way. There's a lot more we're going to hear and learn today. Amanda Petrusich is with us, writer at Pitchfork. She's author of the new book, It Still Moves, Lost Songs, Lost Highways, and the Search for the Next American Music. You can join the conversation. Will American roots music always inform our next American music? Does the sound that bubbled up out of Clarksville and Nashville, Memphis, and Appalachia just keep on coming, changing? We're at 800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American roots and the next American music. My guest is Amanda Petrusich. She's a music critic for Pitchfork, Paste Magazine, pop music critic for the New York Times. Her new book is It Still Moves, Lost Songs, Lost Highways, and the Search for the Next American Music. Behind us, Caliphone with Black Metal Valentine. You can join the conversation. Is this your soundtrack now? Iron and Wine, Sufjan Stevens, Freakwater, Fruit Vats, Animal Collective, Caliphone. And what's the message, the yearning of indie folk, freak folk, alt country, bringing it all or a whole lot of it right back? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. And yes, before this hour's over, we will also look at Axl Rose, Guns N' Roses, and the new album, Chinese Democracy, a whole different thing, as they say. But behind us right now, Caliphone. Amanda, tell us about this group. This is from their 2006 album, Roots and Crowns. You describe Caliphone as a band that reimagines Americana for a nation more reliant on machines than the grace of God, and we can hear that.
Yeah, Caliphone are one of my favorite bands. They're based out of Chicago, and they've been, you know, active for quite a long time, and I think what they do is really tremendously indicative of what we're talking about here as the next American music. I mean, they mix, and they'll happily talk about this for hours, they'll mix bits of Delta blues and Appalachian folk and North Carolina string band music. And I know Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music was an enormous influence for them. And all of these old traditions that have been, you know, reinvented a zillion different ways, and they're mixing that with synthesizers and found sound and samples and tape loops. And the resulting songs, for me, feel really contemporary. I mean, they, you know, again, sort of going back to what we were talking about earlier, they sound like what I see when I look outside my car window.
Let's get a call from Kentucky, Hopkinsville, Kentucky. And Danny, you're on the air with Amanda Petrusich.
Hello. Great to be with you guys. You know, I'm 56 years old and was raised within 30 miles where Bill Monroe was born. But really, I didn't really get so much into the Americana and country. Most folks my age, you know, it was Iron Butterfly and this, that, and the other. But there was some artists during that period of time, like Graham Parsons and Jerry Garcia's acoustic work, you know, that really kind of, I think, brought country, you know, made country cool for a whole generation of old hippies. And it's just evolved. I listen to WNKU in Covington every now and then when I'm up in that area. Great Americana public radio station. And I used to think when I was living up there for a while that they were sneaking in at night and taking my CDs and playing on the air.
Hey, Danny, it's great to have your call. And Amanda, that is, I mean, it's so interesting how here it is, the wave comes around again. But it's interesting at the same time because Danny mentions Graham Parsons, and somewhere in the book I recall you're quoting one of your sort of hipster, new Americana people saying, what do you want us to do, go back and be Graham Parsons all over again? So, yes, it's part of that, but at the same time there's a deliberate distancing. What's that about?
Sure. You know, I mean, Graham Parsons is actually obviously a fantastic artist, and in many ways I think was one of the first people to sort of pioneer what we refer to now as alt country, which now is sort of thought of as a mix of kind of punk rock and classic traditional sort of hard country. But yeah, absolutely. I do think there is a kind of self-conscious distancing from, you know, from some of these things, although on the other hand, I think they're also embraced. So it's a kind of tricky balance of, you know, and I'm sure, Tom, you've experienced this too. You talk to bands and the last thing they want to talk about are their influences, because no one wants right. to think that what they're doing is not 100% original. But of course, I think it's interesting too. A lot of these people making this music now are in their late 20s or early 30s. So, you know, this isn't necessarily their parents' music either. And I think part of the reason they're maybe less ashamed to talk about it is because it's sort of record collector music in a way. You know, it's things that they've dug up from the record stores, you know, records they bought for 50 cents at their local Salvation Army. It's a little more obscure, and I think in some ways that makes it, you know, a little bit cooler, a little bit easier to talk about.
It's interesting, the whole appeal of obscurity as opposed to anything that's more mainstream, very vivid in your travels and in this music. But let's keep that back and forth going. Here, 1927, the Carter family, just remember, the poor orphan child.
I hear a low, faint voice that says, Papa and Mama dead. Comes from the poor orphan child that must be closed and thin.
Okay, there's the Carter family. Who doesn't know it? I mean, will that circle be unbroken? Probably. But then you take us to pair this with Freakwater. Introduce us to Freakwater, Amanda.
Sure. Freakwater, again, are sort of one of the first sort of originators of again this kind of movement in alt country, and of course it came much later. They were, you know, around the same time that Uncle Tupelo, which later split into Wilco and Sun Vault, around that same time when bands were sort of starting to mix punk rock and traditional country music, and Freakwater, actually, when I sat down and talked to them, it was interesting because they, you know, pointed out to me, and I realize now I should have thought of this earlier, but they pointed out that punk rock and country music are sort of rooted in the same kind of idea of struggle, you know, of sort of pushing against, you know, hardship in a way. And so the pairing kind of made sense. And I they're from Louisville, Kentucky, and I think, I will just let them play their songs. I think it speaks for itself.
Let's hear it. Jack the Knife from Freakwater, Catherine Irwin and Janet Beveridge Bean, plus you'll hear.
There was a knife I left behind. I was always searching for and never find. A knife I believed was right here in my pocket. The display still flashes through my mind.
Freakwater, 2005. Let's take a call from East Haddam, Connecticut, and Sarah. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, what do you know, Sarah?
What's that?
What do you know?
Oh, what do I know? I was just going to share some of my directions. I've been working on this scenario for a while, coming up with a new type of music. I guess my history is I'm from St. Louis, and I was playing original ragtime competitions when I was about 7.
Okay.
And I'm all grown up now. I'm 32, and but I've been mixing kind of reggae, rap, dub, and ragtime, and you know, all kinds of things. Violin from June Carter, and but basically slowing down ragtime melodies and just analyzing them, and it's really cool. And also like the marching band spirit of kind of what you're talking about, taking it out of the machine,
mm-hmm.
and just getting groups of people who are good at the instrument or bad, it all like sounds organic and cool. And so I'm trying to start stuff like that in New York City, like speakeasy style stuff. It's great.
Reggae, rap, yeah. and ragtime all at once. And does reaching back feel natural to you, or derivative, or necessary, or home? What's the impulse to reach back?
I grew up on a farm and kind of near East St. Louis, you know, where, you know, all the great people, you know, Miles Davis, and it's just like a place where music kind of lets you become whoever you want to be and then kind of carries you wherever in the world. And so reggae and ragtime are both rooted, as you said, in the same kind of scenario of it's not upsetting music, it's just kind of letting you free of all the troubles, and especially nowadays, people are really grasping for that kind of music. So.
Sarah, good luck with it, and thanks for calling. Ragtime since you were 7 in East St. Louis. It's a great picture. Let's get another call here from Somerville, Massachusetts, and Dana. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you hear, Dana?
Well, I guess my point or comment is I think it's great that we're hearkening back to traditional music as a new influence in modern music, but I guess I can't help but want to hear more support and interest in modern music that's pushing the envelope a little more, a little less borrowing in terms of a standardized approach to revisiting, and more emphasis on moving ahead and trying to forge new ground.
So what? It's too derivative to your ear? I mean, leaves you wondering why we're reaching back, but doesn't music always reach back? It's too literal in that reach, Dana? What?
Certainly, I think it needs to, but it also needs to evolve. It needs to evolve to be a forward-moving, organic entity onto itself without you know, sort of borrowing so much as it is just pushing the envelope, trying to reach for things that we haven't heard before.
It's a great question, maybe the question. Dana, thanks for calling in with that. I want to bring another voice into our conversation right now, if I may, along with Amanda Petrusich from Marlborough, Vermont. We're joined by Robin MacArthur. She and her husband formed the Vermont-based indie folk duo Red Heart the Ticker. Robin MacArthur, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And I have to say, I was introduced to your music by Amanda last night. Mm-hmm. You know, I love it. It's terrific.
Oh, thank you.
But you heard Dana's remark right there. I mean, there's something very new about your music, but also something very much, watch out for the snare drum, something very much drawing on the old. Do you see that as a, I don't know, is it a crutch, a root?
Well, I would say for us, you know, my husband and I are the duo, and I would say that our style comes more out of necessity than out of choice. And so I think if we tried to do something purely new, we wouldn't be successful at it. But I think my husband's coming from more of a jazz fusion and rock and roll background, and I'm coming from this very rooted folk and country background, and so what we have is just this eclectic mix of the two. And you know, we're not revivalists in any way, but to intentionally try and cut out that the old influence wouldn't be natural at all.
Let's hear just a little bit of your work with your husband Tyler Gibbs. This is Robin MacArthur and Tyler Gibbs, Red Heart the Ticker, Yellow Bird.
Tired. watch a yellow bird fly.
Red Heart, the ticker, Yellow Bird. Pretty new song and wonderful, Robin. I think it's just fantastic. Amanda, when you hear this and you hear what Robin and Tyler Gibbs are doing, how do you see it in this great chain of musical being you describe, Amanda?
Sure. Well, I'm obviously a huge fan of Robin and Tyler's, and I think the music they make is really lovely. And I think, of course, sure, it does, borrow from the folk tradition that Robin is very much a part of. But I think, I also hear things in their songs, and Robin can probably talk more accurately about this. But, they toy with certain really sort of contemporary tweaks, tape loops or maybe a kind of unusual drum beat that you wouldn't hear, on an old folkways record. So to me it is, American music is in some ways a kind of constant series of iterations. It's one single narrative that's constantly being updated and tweaked. And, for me, I think the ways in which it's changing, they might be subtle sometimes and they might be small, but I think they're sort of what keeps it moving, so to speak.
Let's get a call from Meg in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Meg, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I called because I'm a 50-something, and as I said to your person in the phone... In any case, I called because I spent my miserable adolescence lying on my bedroom floor listening to Joni Mitchell. And suddenly I'm finding artists like Sufjan Stevens, like M. Ward, and of course Keb Moe, and a whole slew of others available to me on iTunes. It's wonderful. And I also want to say that I think that something like the Sufjan Stevens Christmas album is exactly, it's a perfect thing for me to listen to, but it's also something that my students really like. I teach high school, and it's a really nice time in music, and it's so great to be able to have an archive like iTunes to be able to sort of plug into and search. Find artists.
Everything available, the old and the new. Meg, thanks for calling. Robin, how do you describe the thing that you and Tyler Gibbons are, I use the word yearning here, but there's a kind of yearning I hear in this music. At the same time, it references the old, in Yellow Bird there, we hear you dip into that minor key.
Mm-hmm.
Are you yearning for something old, something authentic, something, how would you describe it in this music?
Well, I was thinking about this just because I knew I'd be on the show, mm-hmm. of what the new Americana is. And I believe that there's a yearning, I think there's a yearning in our music, and that's kind of a separate issue, but I think that there's a yearning with our entire generation for authenticity, because it's such a time of, materialistic excess in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole kind of the superficial aspects of it are 30-somethings or 20-somethings wearing trucker caps and garage mechanic shirts that say Fred,
right,
and that kind of thing.
Right.
But I think that at the heart of that is this yearning for something real and simpler and stripped down and not commercial and anti-establishment. So, and that's definitely, we do have some pop and indie rock elements to our music, but at the heart of it, we're just making music because we live in this little cabin in the woods and it gets dark and lonely and we need to make music together.
Amanda, to make music, everybody needs to make a living as well, but in a way there is this anti-commercial, anti-big success vibe among this generation of musicians, Amanda.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, Freakwater talked to me about that. I mean, when I asked them to define alt-country music, they said, it's country music made by people who, either don't know how or don't want to make any money. And I'm sure that this is probably a cross-generational thing, but there's a kind of deep-seated wariness of commercialism or kind of signing over that check. It's sort of, what am I signing over? What am I giving up? Can it be authentic and profitable at the same time? That's a sort of age-old American question, I think. But I think what Robin's saying is very true and very interesting, that there seems to be this sort of movement amongst kind of younger urban people to sort of reach to this kind of country. You know, they have these sort of country aspirations in a way, and I perhaps because it feels comforting. It sounds good. You know, it sounds warm.
It sounds great when Red Heart the Ticker does it. Robin MacArthur and Tyler Gibbons. Robin in Marlboro, Vermont, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
We'll go out with the Jack Knives back in a minute. 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about American roots and the next American music this hour. Behind me right now, Fleet Foxes with White Winter Hymnal. And we'll hear a precedent for that. Amanda Petrusich is with us. She's a music critic for Pitchfork, Paste Magazine, pop music critic for the New York Times, author of the new book, It Still Moves, Lost Songs, Lost Highways, and the Search for the Next American Music. I hate to even talk over that, but yet I am. We're at 800-423-8255. Let's just listen. Fleet Foxes, White Winter Hymnal. Amanda Petrusich joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Amanda, introduce us to Fleet Foxes.
Sure. Well, I'm so excited we got to play one of their songs because Fleet Foxes, I think, released one of my very favorite records from 2008. They're a band from Seattle. Their frontman, Robin Picknold, is quite young. He just turned 22 a little while ago. And they released an EP last winter and their first full-length record this spring, and they are also signed to Sub Pop Records, which is the home of Sam Beam, who we heard a little bit earlier. And Fleet Foxes, I think, you know, sort of draw from a very large spectrum of Americana music, and even a little bit from Graham Parsons, who we were speaking about a little while ago. But one of the things that struck me when I first heard this album was the influence of Sacred Harp or Shape Note Singing, which was a sort of four-part harmony style that was, you know, really popular, I mean, around the turn of the century. And you'll hear it in their harmonies, and I think maybe we can listen to a little bit of...
We've got some of the Alabama Sacred Harp Singers, 1959. Let's listen, just to get them back-to-back here, Sherburn. There we go, from Sacred Harp there to what we came in on, Fleet Foxes' White Winter Hymnal, 1959, and much older in that tradition, speaks to 2008 here, and you can hear that conversation loud and clear, Amanda.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is actually one of the less literal pairings in a way, but, you know, what's amazing is you go to see Fleet Foxes and you'll see a whole, you know, rock club full of 25-year-olds kind of stop and sing these harmonies that Fleet Foxes are doing, which is very similar to the sort of spirit as well of Sacred Harp singing, which was, you know, designed so that an entire congregation who perhaps couldn't read music could sing along with these sacred songs. So not only is it a sort of texture and a kind of literal harmony that they're lifting, but I think also that kind of sense of community and of singing together, which is, you know, kind of remarkable in 2008 that can still happen.
Let's get another back and forth here. Many will recognize this. It's I Wonder As I Wander, John Jacob Miles. This recording, Christmas Carol, recorded in 1958, is based on three lines sung to him by a girl in North Carolina in 1933.
I wonder as I wander out under the sky, how Jesus, our Savior, did come for to die for poor, ornery people like you and like I.
John Jacob Miles, 1958 there, Kentucky-born, collector of American ballads, famed falsetto-wielding dulcimer player. Now, we're going to fast forward here to 2004, Animal Collective. We'll hear who could win a rabbit animal collective. Tell us about them, Amanda.
Sure. They're based out of Brooklyn now, originally from Baltimore. And they're one of these sort of new Americana bands that are clearly drawing from the sort of, you know, the texture and the kind of organic sounds of the music that we're talking about, but mixing it with a much more sort of avant-garde experimental music tradition as well. So I think the hybrid that they've come up with is, you know, in response to one of the callers who spoke earlier about hearing something that sounds completely new, I think Animal Collective may fill that role for you. It's certainly unprecedented to my ears.
Not nearly as literal, but you can hear the echo. Let's listen. This is Who Could Win a Rabbit from the Animal Collective's 2004 album, Sung Tong.
Hungry bread and butter hustle. You'll be doing it a while. There is only care. Where's your relaxation? Where's the power quiet? Put it up and hating on my new perspective. Been hurrying along. The meal is ever done. You can win a rabbit. You can have a rabbit. Or is it fast?
Animal Collective. Let's get a call from Richmond, Virginia. Carl, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and thank you for taking my call. I've been a fan of yours for quite a while now.
Wonderful to have you.
Amanda, I was just up in Charlottesville last week to see Alan Toussaint at the recently renovated Paramount Theater up there, which is a jewel case.
Oh, absolutely.
I just turned 60 years old recently, so I have been a fan of the American idiom for quite some time. I visited my father once back in 1983 after he had stayed up 24 hours watching the then MTV, Judas Priest, and Quiet Riot, and declared loudly that the folk idiom in American popular music was dead. I'm glad to see that he was quite wrong. Folk music has been a part of the American pop music ever since the Byrds, really, and even before. But the Byrds really popularized folk music in American popular music. And I look at what is going on here right now as just a continuation of it, derivative or not, that the youth of America tend to incorporate the folk music with their own experiences and pass that on.
And we hear it regenerating right there in every breath of that song. Carl, thanks for calling in from Richmond. Great to hear you feel you're listening there. Let's go to East Lansing, Michigan. Tina, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to tell you about one of our local roots groups called Steppin' In It. And they kind of sing about Michigan, and of course Michigan's been in a difficult industrial economic time for a while, so a lot of their songs come out of that. Which I don't know if you've heard about them, but they're really good. And then they also talk about the beauty of Michigan and why we're all still up here, you know, looking at the beautiful waters and all the wonderful things. But their songs are just, I think it's now, it's roots of now.
Tina, do you think hard times drive an appetite for that in some way?
Yes, I do. And I think people need to hear what's going on, and they also need to be uplifted. And I think that's what this group does. They have a wide audience throughout the country, but, you know, a lot of their audience centers around, you know, the Great Lakes areas, and certainly in Michigan and Ann Arbor and, of course, Lansing, where they're from, you know, where they're based. And but they've been in West Virginia, and they just sing about, I think, the times.
There's a shout-out for Steppin' In It out of Michigan. I should say you can see a complete playlist of everything we're playing today at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's get one more call here from Burlington, Vermont. Harry. Hi, Harry. You're on the air with Amanda Petrusich.
Hi. How you doing, Tom?
Well,
my question is, you know, the landscape of music obviously evolves, but it seems to me that folk music is the last in line. And you can talk all you want about, you know, how derivative, everything is basically derivative, in my opinion. But why is it taking folk music so long to jump on to incorporate sampling and technology into itself? It seems like every other area of the music industry, maybe not so much classical music, but is getting on this. And that's where the youth is at, and that's where the message is. that was the message of folk music of the 60s.
Harry, you're breaking up a little, but let me raise it with Amanda, and thanks for calling sampling, Amanda. Harry says, how about it? When does all this, you know, new free folk and everything else bring the sampling in? I think we've heard some already today, but what role does sampling play?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Harry, and I think, yeah, you know, we have heard a little bit, and I think it's beginning to be incorporated perhaps with a bit more gusto. But one of the things that's unique to folk music and unique to a lot of the songs that we're talking about today is that, you know, people feel very protective of this music in a way, and some, you know, folk purists or country purists can be, you know, sort of almost militant, I think, about, you know, the ways in which they'd like to see that sound preserved. I think certainly we've seen that in Nashville with the sort of, you know, kind of countless variations on country music. And of course, country music purists are sort of outraged by what passes for country music today. You know, and I think, while I find that thinking sort of problematic, I think it also comes from a place of real love. You know, I mean, they just love this music so much, they don't want it to change. And I think we see that more with this sort of acoustic, sort of organic kind of front porch, you know, what I call Americana music. I think that impulse to sort of keep it pure and keep it real is perhaps stronger there than with other forms of music. And that might be part of the reason why it's taken a little bit longer for things like sampling to integrate in.
All right, Amanda, take a deep breath. The book is It Still Moves. And it's been a great tour. But take a deep breath, because we're going to jump in an entirely different direction right here, right now. Everybody's talking about this week Guns N' Roses, Axl Rose, out with his new album, Chinese Democracy. 13 years of work, $13 million. We're going to hear in a moment from critic Brett Milano about it. But let's listen to the title track, Chinese Democracy. Okay, and we are off. A little Chinese democracy there. China not so happy about it. Their Ministry of Culture refusing to let it be distributed. Amanda, jump in here with us. I want to welcome Brett Milano, music critic. He's written for the Boston Herald, Globe, Phoenix, author of The Sound of Our Town, A History of Boston Rock and Roll. But we're looking all the way to Beijing right now. Brett Milano, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Axl Rose has been doing what with this album for 13 years?
Probably doing the same thing with this album over and over for 13 years, because I think what we've got is the same collection of songs that he has been endlessly retooling and retooling and polishing and obsessing and somehow getting them to the point where he was finally willing to let go of them.
Rolling Stone calls it a great, audacious, unhinged, and uncompromising hard rock record. What do you say, Brett?
Rolling Stone's pretty good with hyperbole. I think it's a pretty good record. I think it's way better than a lot of the Axl haters were expecting. I mean, everyone thought it might be the rock and roll Heaven's Gate. It's definitely not that. It's a big, glossy, you can hear every penny that went into it. I think of it as kind of a car chase movie with a lot of really good action scenes in it.
14 studios used here, all kinds of people, all kinds of money, all kinds of time. New York Times says it's also a shipwreck capsized by pretensions and top-heavy production. I guess that's what you do.
It's a bad thing.
That's not a good thing. But remind us of just how big Guns N' Roses was in the 1980s and Axl Rose. I mean, they were huge, and why?
Well, they took the... They brought metal and punk together for one thing. They were the most ferocious band you could ever see. I think they were one of the first bands circa 91 that everybody agreed on, the metal kids, the punk rockers. I mean, they heard the ferocity in it.
Let's hear another cut from Chinese Democracy, and the foreign ministry there not happy about it at all. They said, oh, this is cacophonous, nobody likes to listen to this. Here's a track that's getting maybe the best reviews from the album Better, from Guns N' Roses, new Chinese Democracy, Axl Rose and Better.
Thank you.
Better from Chinese Democracy. David Frick, Rolling Stone, liked this. He said, sounds like hip-hop voicemail. Amanda, we've been talking about, you know, American roots all this hour. What's the root, the long vine that gets us from, you know, way back world where you were traveling to Axl Rose here in Chinese Democracy?
That is a long vine. You know, I think certainly this music, like almost all contemporary rock and roll, is rooted very heavily in the blues. You know, and I think we hear a lot of that. But of course, you know, I mean, the artists we were talking about earlier don't have $13 million. And I kind of love what Brett said about how you can hear every penny of it, you know.
Is it all, is
sort
it all
of intensely produced?
No kidding. Is it all Wayback Machine, Brett? I mean, is it? Do you have to be ready for a trip to the 1980s here? Is this current too somehow?
It's the entire last decade and a half. I mean, you can hear on a lot of these songs very modern production techniques. You can hear very modern things that sounded modern in 1993 when he began work on this record. In a way, this I kind of think of this record as it's the folk music of Sunset Strip, Los Angeles. It's sort of very evocative of that time and place.
You know, Axl Rose is 46 now. If he keeps up at this pace, he'll be 63 before we hear from him again. Does this say he's back in the swing? Back,
and
you know,
he'll still be upset too, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, what do you think? Do you think he's going to be on the scene now or recluse?
I think you don't do this twice. I mean, if you'll think back maybe 10 years ago, Lucinda Williams spent about 6-7 years on an album, and it was seen as very excessive, and she was the drama queen, and she's done about 5 albums since then. So I think once you get something like this out of your system, I think some response kicks in where you say, no, not that again.
Well, maybe. There it is. And the Chinese saying, no thanks, they won't distribute it there, at least not this time. But we read Guns N' Roses had a huge following there, so maybe they'll get it somehow. Brett Milano, thanks for taking a little tiptoe through the Hard Rock Tulips here with us on with Axl Rose, Guns N' Roses. Brett Milano, author of The Sound of Our Town. And Amanda Petrusich, we're going to leave all that nice soft country behind right here and head off with Chinese Democracy. Amanda's book is It Still Moves. Amanda, wonderful to have you with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
We'll go out with Shackler's Revenge from Guns N' Roses, Axl Rose, Chinese Democracy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.